Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
This week on The Wheelhouse. LGBTQ plus rights, local politics, and federal lawsuits. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. It's a show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here. Nearly one in three young LGBTQ plus people say their mental health is poor most of the time, or always, due to anti-LGBTQ plus policies and legislation. It's according to the Trevor Project's 2023 national survey. And more anti-LGBTQ policies seem to be popping up every day, even here in solidly blue Connecticut. Most recently in Enfield, the town council passed a resolution saying only certain flags can fly at town buildings. Flags representing the state and country, as well as the POW/MIA flags, the prisoner of war missing in action flags. Many see this as an attack on the pride flag, specifically. In response, about 100 people showed up at a rally against the change. And with me to talk about some of these local developments here before we have more of a national picture on LGBTQ plus rights, Matt Dwyer, editor of All Things Considered here on Connecticut Public. Good morning, Matt Dwyer. How are you?
Hi, Frankie. Thank you for having me on the show.
Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show. We hope your son feels better as well, too. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Yep, nothing major. He's good.
Walk me through what happened in Enfield, Connecticut. Who made this call?
So the town council, and I guess maybe the thing that changed recently is that control of the town council in Enfield switched from Democrats to Republicans in the last election in November. So the previous town council in Enfield under the Democrats had essentially passed a policy that they would fly a very, very large pride flag, sort of like the sort of traditional rainbow style pride flag on town hall during Pride Month in June every year. So back on January 8th, the Republicans at a meeting proposed and passed essentially a change that puts in place, as you mentioned earlier, a new policy for which flags can fly. Now, the Republicans say that this is about ensuring that like some sort of offensive or bad flag wouldn't be flown. So the town attorney a couple times mentioned ISIS, that he was concerned that someone would ask the town to fly an ISIS flag. I don't know if that's actually happened, but he was concerned something like that might happen. And his concern, as he stated it in the meeting, was that if there's no policy on which flags can be flown, then the town might have to fly any flag from anyone that shows up. And then it could be something offensive. The Democrats, however, on that meeting back on January 8th, the Democrats said, wait a minute, you know, this is really about the pride flag and that this is really just an effort to stop the pride flag from flying. So the ultimate, and that was a very heated meeting back on January 8th. The Republicans, the Democrats were slamming papers down. They're interrupting each other and tempers were flaring. And this was coming up 3.5 hours into a 4-hour long meeting. But ultimately in the end, most of the Republicans voted for this change and most of the Democrats voted against it, but the Republicans hold the majority. So they passed this proposal, which has the effect of stopping the pride flag from being flown on town hall during Pride Month in Enfield.
This is quite the picture you've painted for us. And it kind of brings me back to, I would say, a past trauma here when I'm thinking about local government changing over so quickly in an election. It reminds me of Killingly when it changed essentially because of, the school board in Killingly changed essentially because of a mascot policy, because people ran on wanting to change a mascot that was deemed offensive to Native Americans. And it makes me think about this situation. Now, do we know anything about the platform that some of these Republican members of local government had? Was it similar to Killingly where they might have ran on changing this flag? Was it similar to that? Do we know anything about that?
You know, honestly, I don't cover Enfield day to day. So yes. Goodman, I did not cover the election back in November. So I'm not sure how much this played into the election.
And is anybody saying anything about the military flags and whether or not those can be considered political?
That did not come up much during the meeting back on January 8th. I can add one other thing. I mean, during the meeting, one of the Republican members of the council raised some concerns that an original, even broader version of this proposal might have actually prevented like some veterans groups from displaying their flags on town property.
Gotcha.
Originally, this would have banned like all flags aside from the allowed ones anywhere on town property, or even in buildings, in town buildings, that sort of thing, or even on furniture or furnishings. That part was taken out to allow veterans groups to fly their flags at town events that they hold on town property, which presumably would also allow, if there's a gay rights group having an event on town property, they could hold a flag, they could walk around with a flag, they just couldn't put it on a flagpole or on a town building.
So much rules here, so many rules being enacted, and I would imagine that people feel like they feel some type of way about this, and they've demonstrated, as I've heard. What's the response from the people in town?
Yeah, so that was just a couple of weeks later on January 22nd. There was a large demonstration outside a subsequent town council meeting by gay rights groups, including PFLAG, Enfield. I spoke with one of the organizers of that demonstration, and essentially she sort of described how, you know, for her the pride flag is not something like the ISIS flag, that, you know, that it, for her, this is a symbol of inclusion, and of welcoming and understanding and, you know, accepting people for who they are, that sort of thing. But that demonstration obviously was very, very opposed to this policy. And quite a few people came and spoke at the Enfield Town Council sort of in opposition to this policy.
Has it sent that message, though? I mean, as far as you could tell, are there more people like the person that you just mentioned that are feeling sort of targeted and feeling like this is a restriction against the rights of LGBTQ plus people, that it's discriminatory? Are there any more anecdotes like that?
Yeah, I mean, in the big picture, I mean, this is, I think you'll probably get into this a little bit later, but I mean,
yes,
this is it's something that's happening across the country. I was just reading, I believe there's a proposal similar to this in Florida. And although in Enfield, the Republicans during their meeting were very careful not to mention LGBTQ issues, and the Democrats brought it up sort of accusing the Republicans of targeting the pride flag. And in other states like Florida, these proposals are tending to come up from Republicans. And in some other states, the Republicans will say that they're proposing it, you know, it because they want to prevent sort of indoctrination of children in some way to a lifestyle that they maybe disagree with or feel should not be in the schools.
And then I want to just ask you quickly, this is something that's been shown just a couple of times in Enfield. This flag has only flown just a couple of times, the Rainbow Pride flag.
I believe the policy was put in place in 2022. By the Democrats when they were on the council that allowed the giant pride flag on town hall. I don't know the history before that, if it had flown at all before that. I'm not sure.
And was this so was that a situation where there was a big fight in town in 2022?
I have to admit, I was not there to cover that.
All right. So
I do know that it passed the, I do know it passed the council, I believe 8-2. So it passed the council with quite a bit of support. I don't know in the community what the response was back then.
And then one more question I wanted to ask you, because we were talking about this sort of in the newsroom, but there was a discrimination case in the town. I believe it was actually in the Board of Education in Enfield. So is this something that might be pervasive? At least they're not saying the quiet part out loud here in terms of the flag debate. But is there some kind of situation where there may be discrimination in town?
So that Enfield case that you mentioned with the Board of Education, that goes back a few years. That was a case where a member of the Board of Education essentially went to court, basically accusing the town and the Board of Education of refusing to give her accommodations because she was deaf or hard of hearing. And she had asked to, you know, for example, for people to sort of face her while they spoke or to communicate in writing with her so that she could understand what was going on. And she said that they did not do that. She was on the board for 2 years, the Board of Education. She recently won a lawsuit, and essentially the jury found that the town, in fact, did not make accommodations for her and that they should have. They awarded her damages, but they only awarded her $10 in damages. So that's kind of where that ended up.
We're going to have to watch local government here in Enfield as we watch the situation unfold. And really something that we're seeing across the country as parties switch from as local governments switch from party to party here in elections, a lot of policy changes. Matt, thank you so much for coming in here on short notice and helping us out. And again, you're doing this on Zoom, helping us out as you had to take care of the kids today. I appreciate that very much as a father. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Frankie.
Take care, Matt.
Yep. Bye.
Connecticut towns aren't alone in facing a growing number of policy changes like this one. Orion Rumler, LGBTQ plus reporter for the 19th. He's here to help us put this into the national perspective. Orion, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you so much, Frankie. Glad to be here.
888-720-9677. The number to call if you'd like to join this conversation, 888-720-9677. We're going to have a little short conversation here for the next couple of minutes here, take a break, and then we'll have a larger conversation, Orion, but just you and I. But just really quickly, are bans on pride flags something we're seeing in other states across the country?
Absolutely. And as we were just discussing in Enfield, appreciate that conversation. When Matt was talking about the Republicans were careful not to mention LGBTQ issues, that is how we usually see these flag bans talked about when they're proposed by Republicans in different states. Like in Tennessee right now, Tennessee is considering a bill that would prohibit the display of pride flags in public schools. That bill's been delayed, you know, because it is controversial. And the way this bill has been amended, it would prohibit the display of flags that, quote, represent a political viewpoint included but not limited to a partisan, racial, sexual orientation, gender, or ideological viewpoint. And that's what we saw back in 2021 as well. We saw other states banning pride flags in a way to lump them in to say that this is a political view. But obviously it's not. It's an identity that one can't control. To be gay or queer is not a political stance, although it's being used politically. And is part of our political moment, it's not a political identity. And that is something that advocates have been pointing out. So we are seeing this across the country in Florida. As mentioned earlier, Tennessee is a state I'm watching for this as well. And would also just note from the conversations I've had with experts on mental health, on working with kids, removing pride flags in classrooms can really negatively affect queer students, especially since at a young age, they're probably still navigating their identity, might be in the closet. They're looking for signs of acceptance from the adults around them. And if there are none, that can really harm them.
I asked this question to Matt a little earlier because the political flags thing is very important to highlight. That can include, I would imagine, military flags because people are very passionate about the military, but that can also be politicized. And then something that's also been targeted in the past, the Black Lives Matter flag. So are you hearing the same kind of thing where other flags are coming up in this debate, not just the rainbow flags as well, but there's maybe a counter saying that, hey, you know, why can you flag the military flags, but you can't fly this one? Or maybe attacks against the Black Lives Matter flag. Are you seeing that as well?
Oh, yeah. So this, I saw this back in 2021 as well in St. John's County in Florida. And sometimes these, you know, school policies are really fought at a local level, as y'all discussed. But when I spoke with Associate Superintendent at St. John's County, he said to me very clearly, Pride flags, Black Lives Matter, as well as a thin blue line flag, he said, they've all tried to come into the district and we're trying to keep like them all out. He said, we're trying to keep the schools safe. So in that situation, included Black Lives Matter, also the thin blue line flag. And I think that goes back to the way these bans are presented, our proposer talked about, is to say, like, we're banning political speech, which includes, like you're saying, it can be used against a lot of flags that aren't just the Pride flag.
Yeah, very important that you brought up that thin blue line flag as well, because that's one that could be considered as a counter to a Black Lives Matter flag or a Pride flag. And obviously, these flags can be considered microaggressions as well, but that's something we could talk about more in a little bit. We're just getting started in this conversation I'm having with Orion Rumler, LGBTQ plus reporter for the 19th. We're going to talk to him more after the break. You can call 888-720-9677 if you have any questions. But stay tuned as we have a couple of my colleagues that want to tell you about the great work we do here at Connecticut Public.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davida Umashankar, Hartford Healthcare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We're talking about state-level policies and how some recent restrictions in Connecticut fit into the national landscape. And with me is Orion Rumler, LGBTQ plus reporter for the 19th. Good morning once again, Orion. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Frankie. Good morning.
We were going to take a call, but I don't see the call on my screen anymore. So I'll step away from that for a second. Folks do want to call us 888-720-9677. 888-720-9677. We generally think of Connecticut as pretty protective of LGBTQ plus rights in comparison to some other states. And Orion, I'm not saying you know anything about Connecticut, but it doesn't mean we're immune to restrictions like this, obviously. Are there historically progressive communities running into these policy changes too?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, what we discussed earlier, like, the school board level policies, that is something that's affecting a lot of states, even if they're not a red state. Right now, you know, a lot of Republicans are energized to be elected to school boards, town and city councils across the country. This is where the culture wars are playing out right now, especially in school boards. And, you know, a lot of everyday people feel like they can build a political platform that can get involved to go to the school board. This is not just playing out like within red states. So I think in terms of like when we talk about education policy, it is playing out locally. And I'd also note something interesting about Connecticut. It's actually the only state in the country where state law requires the state education department to create LGBTQ inclusive model curriculum, but does not actually require any schools to use it, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, how many schools and educators have been impacted by this growing effort, do you think, to kind of limit expression and perspectives from LGBTQ plus people? And I guess more than anything, I'm thinking about that activation there where regular people feel compelled to all of a sudden participate in local government. How many states, you talked about Tennessee, Florida earlier, like this activation, this I would imagine is happening on a widespread level.
Yes, I'm not sure how many states have actually banned pride flags, because right now when we think about like anti-LGBTQ education laws, there are a lot of different kinds, and usually the ones that get the most attention are the ones like Florida's Don't Say Gay law.
Yes,
which we are seeing in more schools, and also book bans. And what, like, at the broad level, what we're seeing with school and education policy is states restricting how LGBTQ people and issues can be talked about in the classroom, and whether only 7 states actually completely censor discussions of LGBTQ people in school, and then other states require parental notification if any LGBTQ issues is mentioned in school, and parents can opt out with their kids. And then some states are bringing more legislation that would require, like, that would prevent teachers from using the correct pronouns from, and some states have actually achieved this, especially in Kentucky and Florida, that are restricting how a teacher can interact with the student if they are using pronouns different from what was assigned at birth. So when we talk about education policy in states, it's how can the teacher interact with the students? And then also, usually at a much more local level, it is these pride flag bans or banning flags generally, which also affects pride flags. And taking all this together, advocates see this as restricting speech. They say it's restricting like education as well.
I love that you wrap that up all in a bow in there at the end. But one thing that I really appreciate for the sake of this conversation is the phrase that you used, opt out. Sounds almost like a lunch a la carte menu or something like that. Or, I don't know, like being able to opt out of receiving robocalls. Like the way that this has really been politicized and treated, I would imagine can't be very good for the mental health of young children and also the people that participate in local government and even engage with the news and seeing something like this. So can you talk a little bit more about that impact?
Absolutely. And I appreciate asking about this because seeing in the conversations I've had with parents and just younger queer people, as well as people who work with kids, like seeing a pride flag can be so helpful for a child. Like, even if, because I feel like there's a misconception in anti-LGBTQ rhetoric that like more kids are being groomed into being gay, or just are being conditioned into being gay. And that, you know, isn't the case. Like, usually what's happening is a young kid is like questioning their identity. They're not sure. They're probably like looking for acceptance. They're looking to like learn about themselves. And if you see a teacher with a pride flag, then you can know this adult is safe for me to say, like, I can talk with this adult. Like, I can talk with someone I trust. And this is so important because for a lot of LGBTQ kids, and the Trevor Project has data about this as well, a teacher is the safest person for them to talk to. Many queer kids do not feel like they can talk to their parents about their identity, or they know that they can't. They aren't in a safe house for this. But school is seen as the next best place for queer and trans kids to find a safe adult to talk to. And if schools are implementing more of these restrictions, if there are no obvious signs for like, where is a safe adult I can talk to, that takes away a really important safety net for queer kids.
I want to underscore something that you just said and repeat it so that people may understand this and they could take that away from this conversation. If a local government or a local school board bans a pride flag, it might eliminate an avenue that a student that age has to talk to somebody about it, as you just said, that they're most likely, and I think this is according to the Trevor Project as well, to talk to a teacher about this. It's very important that you said that. Thank you for bringing that up, Orion. I want to continue to not necessarily harp on the negative, but we're going to get to some positive points in a second. But I just want to kind of paint a full picture for our audience to understand this. Give me some ideas about entities that are the most influential players nationally in this attack on LGBTQ plus rights so that people can understand this when they're watching TV and they're maybe hearing some rhetoric or something like that, that they're not blind to this kind of thing.
Thank you so much. And yeah, so groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center have been tracking for years the involvement of far right, usually like lobbying groups like the Heritage Foundation, Alliance Defending Freedom, Family Policy Alliance, on how these groups have helped to spread anti-trans rhetoric and how they've been involved in, you know, anti-LGBTQ rhetoric. Although, as anybody in tune to this space is probably aware, like the focus is especially usually on transgender rhetoric. So these groups have been involved in testimony. Whenever these bills come up, like they'll help bring people into testimony, which LGBTQ advocacy groups do as well. You know, everybody's bringing in folks to testify. And then where it gets more relevant is ADF especially will do legal representation in different court cases against anti-LGBTQ bills. And ADF as well was involved like earlier on, like before 2020, on helping to create model policy, particularly on athlete bills. And a Connecticut example of this, the legal representation point is, you know, right now in Connecticut, federal appeals court revived mm-hmm. that case by four cisgender women about the transgender athletes policy.
And Orion, we're going to get into that a little bit more in the next segment with Katie Barnes. That's why we brought Katie Barnes on to talk about this, because, as you mentioned, ADF does do this job where they come in and they will make this kind of representation. But as you just continue there and you talk about model policy, too, we had a show where we talked about power players in these groups and people. Will they also put money into these local school boards, or at least try to make a candidate, maybe be a kingmaker or something like that?
I haven't delved into that in a story yet, but I do know that Republicans are encouraging, like Republicans want school boards to, and like these local areas to reflect their beliefs in what they see as like their culture war, like to go against like DEI efforts, as we've seen. Like that kind of rhetoric even spread into like national political races. Like school boards are seen by Republicans as like, this is where we can get a foothold into changing some of these policies, even if we can't do it at the state level.
Important that you brought up ADF and you talk about the attack on trans rights and this rhetoric. And we're going to talk about that more in our next segment. But as we continue here, Orion, former President Donald Trump spoken out against inclusive education and trans rights. Have you noticed any changes in his rhetoric during this presidential cycle versus the last? Is he more coded, or is he as out there as he's ever been?
Thank you. So Trump, my job, like I don't watch Trump all the time for my job. Cause we have like political reporters on our team who are covering politics now in that way. But the way I keep tabs on him to cover LGBTQ issues, like to me, his rhetoric on trans people has gotten more extreme. That's not unique to him, however. To me, that's part of a broader shift that's been happening right now as more lawmakers at the state level as well are becoming more explicit in their views on LGBTQ and trans people. And also their legislation is becoming more explicit as well. And we've also, and I think a great example of that is at least 10 states right now are bringing legislation that would redefine what sex means in their state code in ways that would keep trans people from accessing like basic public services, like updating a driver's license and things like that.
Yeah, and I did say that there was a bunch of negatives that we focused on the show and the attacks, and it's important to bring those up though, so that people know where that where those are and maybe outlets that they have to challenge those kind of things, or at least an understanding of where the opposition is coming from in terms of where it is. But locally, the Manchester School Board drafts a policy to support transgender and gender nonconforming schools. This is a local school board that's actually not too far away from the town of Enfield in Connecticut. So are you now seeing, in response to these changes in other locales, are you seeing some of these other districts and some of these other town governments try to come out and support the rights of people?
Yes, we are seeing that, and also at the state level as well. In response to, you know, book bans, some states like California are passing laws to prevent books on LGBTQ or racial identities from being banned. We're also seeing a lot of states pass shield laws to protect gender-affirming care, because 23 states have banned that care, for the states passing shield laws, in a couple of cases, that's just a governor signing an executive order, because their legislature is predominantly Republican, and that kind of shield law couldn't pass.
We talked about acceptance being something that many students may not get because of something, some of these laws that have been passed. What about this? What kind of positive message is being sent to these communities by this?
Thank you. And what positive message is being sent to communities by what specifically?
I would say when some of these restrictions are, there's instead of restrictions being passed, there are these protections being passed. What kind of message can that send? Can that help alleviate the trauma, so to speak, in any way?
I definitely hope so, because I agree. I think the headlines that get the most attention, especially nationally, are, like we've seen over the past few years, anti-LGBTQ bills, rhetoric has gotten more extreme, there's more of it, there's more worry. And I've had conversations with families who have shared with me devastating stories about how, like, watching some kids, like, will watch the hearings of these bills, and it will really negatively affect them. And that's been really hard to hear about. And I know some parents of queer and trans youth are like trying to like insulate their kids from being exposed to too much of this, because this does dominate the headlines. But I do hope that more families will see that states are trying to pass protective laws. And then that can help them know that they're not alone.
Orion Rumler, you want to follow his work in the 19th. Thank you so much, Orion, for coming on the show. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We really appreciated the conversation and, more than anything, your expertise.
Thank you so much, Frankie.
Thank you so much. Next up, a federal court has revived a case brought by four cisgender women in Connecticut. You just heard Orion mention it. The suit threatens a Connecticut policy that allows transgender girls to compete on girls' school sports teams. Join the conversation, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
So, you've never donated to this station before? That's okay. Public Media Giving Days are a great time to make your first gift. Here's how.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. This hour, we're diving into LGBTQ plus rights here in Connecticut and beyond. And with me now is Katie Barnes, writer for ESPN and author of the book Fair Play, How Sports Shape the Gender Debates. Welcome to The Wheelhouse, Katie. Thanks for being here and coming back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Anybody wants to join us in this conversation, 888-720-9677. 888-720-9677. When you came on the show last time, Katie, we talked about a 2020 lawsuit that was filed by four female cisgender high school track and field athletes from here in Connecticut. Runners, track and field athletes, they say they allowing transgender girls to participate in girls track and field is a violation of Title IX. Case dismissed. But recently, a federal appeals court revived the case. Why is it resurfacing now, Katie?
This case has had many lives. As you pointed out, it was filed almost 4 years ago, actually February 12, 2020, was when this case was originally filed in district court in Connecticut, and was dismissed as moot, as you point out as well. There was an appeal after that to the Second Circuit of Appeals. And it was originally dismissed there too. But in 2023, that case was heard en banc, which means that the entire Circuit of Appeals, all of the judges, instead of just a panel of a few of them, heard the entire case. And the question was not about the merits of the case, meaning not about whether or not the core question of does Connecticut's transgender inclusive athletic policy violate Title IX, but whether the cisgender girls who were filing this lawsuit had standing to do so, meaning did they have the legal right to challenge this existing policy. And that was what the Circuit of Appeals was weighing in on. And so they ended up ruling near the end of last year that in fact, these cisgender girls do have standing, and remanded the case back to district court to rule on the merits. So 4 years later, there will be a ruling of some sort on the merits of the question of whether or not the CAIC's transgender inclusive policy is in fact in violation of Title IX.
Katie, I didn't know how to ask you about that question because it is such a tough situation to unpack. You'd almost have to be a legal expert, but you must be, because this was tremendous. And the very important part there is the merit really shifting, not necessarily talking about the merit of the case, but whether or not there was standing there. And that's kind of what I want to get into. The four plaintiffs in Connecticut aligned with the national group, the Southern Poverty Law Center calls, and quote, anti-LGBTQ plus hate group. This is, of course, the Alliance Defending Freedom. We just talked about them with Orion a little bit. The Alliance and the students sued a state governing body of high school sports, several area boards of education, but they also targeted local student athletes Andrea Yearwood and Terry Miller, right?
Yes. Andrea Yearwood and Terry Miller were not sued directly, of course.
That's right.
But the ACLU did intervene on their behalf, as they were the two athletes in question who were competing at that time in the sport in question.
But what I mean by that is they're being targeted in the lawsuit, and there's been some very discriminatory language shared in the lawsuit as well.
Yeah, I mean, the language is... it's language that I do not use personally, but it's consistent with the Alliance Defending Freedom's viewpoint in terms of what it is they believe and what it is that they are arguing from both a legal perspective, but then, of course, their overall philosophy when it comes to transgender Americans.
And when we talk about what the case is now really talking about in these appeals courts, this is the lawsuit, right, where it got people asking, do wins and losses get you track scholarships, or does your individual effort attract the scouts?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's been really interesting about the ongoing discussion when it comes to transgender athletes across the country is that it's not always clear that everyone in the conversation fully understands how sports operates from a mechanics standpoint, in that when you look at track and field, for example, your times matter. Whether or not you run at a specific meet, that doesn't necessarily matter in the same way that it would in basketball, being invited to a showcase to play in front of college scouts, where you're evaluated on a number of things, not just how many shots you hit. Track and field is much more absolute, cut and dry than some other sports. It's very clear in that way. So in that sense, it's, I think, a challenging part of the conversation. But what is important about the Connecticut case is that, one, it is the only example of the Alliance Defending Freedom going on offense, as it were, when it comes to these lawsuits and being successful in that way. It's one of the first of its kind, and it predates some of the more controversial representations of transgender athletes competing with success around the country. And so in that sense, it's an incredibly important legal discussion.
What are the ramifications of the Second District Court continuing this lawsuit? What are some of the reverberating impacts it could have on transgender athletes throughout the country? Not just in Connecticut, obviously, but in beyond.
Yeah, you know, that's a really hard question to answer because there are a number of other cases that were filed later that have moved further along. So there is a case out of Idaho that, you know, where HB 500, the Idaho law that affected transgender athletes, was not allowed to go into effect and was successfully challenged there. And the Ninth Circuit of Appeals upheld that challenge and continues to not allow that law to go into effect. That will likely be appealed at some point in time to the Supreme Court. You have a case out of Arizona that is moving through the courts, as well as a case out of West Virginia that is also moving through the courts. And the state of West Virginia has asked the Supreme Court twice to weigh in, and the Supreme Court has declined to do so. So there are a number of legal challenges around laws in particular that have been passed at the state level, which are fundamentally different than the question being asked in Connecticut. However, I think it's really hard to get an idea of what the possible ramifications could be, simply because so much of the question doesn't necessarily apply in the way that it used to. There was a lot of urgency in 2020, specifically around Connecticut and this and the question of track and field, because we were in track and field season. But these athletes haven't competed against each other since February 14th of 2020. And of course, a lot of that had to do with COVID. And so it really disrupted, I think, what could have happened legally in this case and a lot of those questions. But regardless, you know, the question of a high school association's athletic policy that is inclusive is separate from a state law that could be discriminatory. And Connecticut is not the only state that has an inclusive policy. And so you're looking at states where transgender athletes can compete, and they're the only states where they can compete right now. If those policies are found to be in violation of Title IX, that will raise a lot of questions and will expand restriction, Katie, in a way that was not anticipated.
Katie, where can people get your book?
They can buy anywhere where books are sold.